from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
I walked into the room and she was sitting on the edge of the bed and coughing up blood.
That was the first time in Teresa Brown's nursing career that a patient took an unexpected turn and suddenly died. Brown became a nurse after abandoning her first career, teaching English at Tufts University. Today she talks about taking care of cancer patients, helping people recover, and comforting the dying. She's written a memoir. Also, we hear from Juliette Binoche, who's starring in a production of the Greek tragedy Antigone. She won an Oscar for her performance in The English Patient. Binoche was discovered by director Jean-Luc Godard after he saw a photo that her boyfriend reluctantly took after she kept insisting.
But my expression was like pissed off at him.
That's coming up on Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, weeknights on Comedy Central. It's the same show you love, but with one teeny tiny difference. Introducing The Daily Show with new host Trevor Noah, weeknights on Comedy Central and on the Comedy Central app.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you've ever been hospitalized or spent time in the hospital visiting someone you care about, you know how important the nurses are. The doctors make rounds, but nurses are there all day and night. And the difference between a caring, attentive nurse and one who's just going through the motions makes a huge difference in the recovery and comfort level of patients under their care. My guest, Teresa Brown, decided to become a nurse in her 30s after having taught English at Tufts University. She spent years as a hospital nurse working with cancer patients, including patients who had bone marrow or stem cell transplants. Now she does home palliative care. She's written op-ed articles about health from a nurse's point of view for the New York Times and has just written her second memoir about nursing. It's called The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. Teresa Brown, welcome to Fresh Air. As medicine has changed, nursing has changed with it. You've had to do things as a nurse that your predecessors in nursing would not have had to do because the technology, the forms of chemo didn't exist yet. One of the things you've done is work on a bone marrow replacement ward as a nurse. So there you were seeing patients who were at their absolute most vulnerable. Because why don't you describe what the procedure is of bone marrow transplant, like how it basically kills the immune system.
Right. So a bone marrow transplant is technically what we call a rescue treatment, which refers to the fact that we've given the patients such an extensive amount of aggressive chemotherapy that we have completely obliterated any trace of an immune system in their body, including what's really at the core of the bone marrow, the part of our body that makes all the different blood cells. So then we give people an infusion of bone marrow, and now actually it's stem cells, but we still call them bone marrow transplants. We give that infusion, and the idea is that it engrafts into the patient's bones and gives them back a new immune system. But there's a long period there, long for being in the hospital, when they have no immune system. They're completely vulnerable. They don't have platelets, which we can give them through transfusions. You know, red cells, they don't have enough of those either. We can also transfuse those. But the really important thing is keeping them safe because it's so easy for them to get sick. And if they get sick, they get really, really, really sick.
They have no defenses.
Right, right.
So what are some of the things you have to do for patients who've had those transplants that you wouldn't have to do for other people who actually have immune systems?
Well, one thing is geographic in terms of the hospital unit. Those patients stay in a part of the floor that's behind double doors on both sides. Their doors stay shut. The doors are actually alarmed, and we keep positive air pressure inside so that when the door opens, say there's someone out in the hallway who has the flu, who's coughing, the positive air in the room will keep those germs outside the room. And the rooms actually have this hideous alarm if the doors are left open. Lots of hand washing, being very careful with gloves, anything that's going into their body, we have to be very careful with. So pretty much all of them have permanent intravenous lines. We've got to always alcohol them off before we give anything, make sure that we change IV fluids on a set schedule so that nothing's hanging around that could contaminate them.
And what about the kind of personal care that you provide patients after a transplant?
Lots of watching and observing and talking and figuring out how are you feeling today. People can get terrible mouth sores. We're also really watching out for fevers and just any signs that someone is not feeling good. Often it's a false alarm. It's because they're exhausted and they need a chance to get more rest. But you've really got to pay attention to that nagging sense of, I don't think something's going right here, because a fever can very quickly turn into a full-blown infection. And if one of these patients, we call it spikes a temp, we'll start antibiotics on them right away, because they found, if they waited until they drew blood cultures and found out what the person was actually infected with, they ended up dying. It was too slow a process.
One of your patients, who you describe in your book, brought in a lot of like Clorox wipes. And right before the procedure, right before the bone marrow transplant, she had her friends and family just like wiping down the floor and the walls and the bed railing and everything with the Clorox wipes. And you make it seem like the nurses thought like, gosh, she is just like a real handful. She's like too much. But then she actually finds, or one of her friends or family finds, a dust ball underneath the bed that's like dust and hair, and it's exactly what should not be in the room. And she presents it to you and says, look what I found. This is like totally unacceptable. And by the way, change the shower curtain because that looks dirty too. Was she already in one of those special rooms?
She was already in one of the special rooms.
See, that's terrifying.
It is. And this person did that. And she's not the only patient who's done that either. We've had other people come in with Clorox wipes and cleaning rituals. And we do look at people like that as being annoying and, as you said, too much. But the truth of it is, there's a reason for them doing what they're doing. And unfortunately, it might be needed in cases, which is terrible to admit.
So what did you do when the patient presented the dust ball to you?
Just felt mortified. And there's nothing I could say. I'm sorry, doesn't really cut it. Wow, guess we should have cleaned your room a little better. What can you say? That's absolutely wrong. And the hospital had gone back and forth from cutting the amount of cleaning staff to save money, and then we would have situations like this. Even worse, I had a patient's family member who found a really, really dirty bathroom and was constantly complaining about the state of the visitor bathrooms, and then even her husband's bathroom was dirty, and there's no excuse for it, and I can't explain it except to say that it's really, really wrong-sided to think that saving money on housekeepers is a good way to save money. It's absolutely not.
Well, you don't want them to save money on nurses either. You've been through that, right? What are some of the cost-cutting measures at hospitals you've worked at that have affected nursing care?
Yeah, there's a sense that you can stretch a nurse just like an elastic band and sort of, well, someone called off today. That means a nurse calls in and says that she's sick or her car broke down and or he won't be there. And sometimes we're able to get someone onto the floor to take that person's place, but often we're not, or an aide might not be able to show up for whatever reason. And then the assumption is just, well, the nurses will do all the work that the aide would have done. And the problem is that people do not stretch like rubber bands, and even rubber bands will break if you stretch them too far. So I can't put my finger on, oh, at this point I was overworked and this terrible, terrible thing happened. It's not that dramatic, but it's you can have a whole cascade of little details that add up to wow, someone really didn't get the care they needed.
So when you were working in oncology in the hospital, did you have to administer chemo?
Yes.
What's it like knowing that the medicine that you are infusing your patient with might really help them, is maybe even likely to really help them, and at the same time it's going to cause, in the short term, pretty bad side effects?
It's intense, and we go in and give chemo with special thick plastic gowns on and two layers of gloves. And I've
Because it's that corrosive?
Yes. Well, we worry about spatter or spray or accidental overdose over time. They didn't used to require that oncology nurses wore that level of protection, and then testing showed that there was exposure. The concern is, if you're doing this four or five, six times a week, could you get enough in your system to make a difference? So I've had patients say to me, what does that mean that you're dressed like that and you're putting that right into my vein?
That's a good question.
It is a good question. And I would always say, well, they're worried about cumulative exposure. And they would, depending on the patient, some would say, oh, I get that. And some would say, uh-huh, right. because they know. They know these are hard drugs. And I just try to focus on, if they don't get this, they'll die. And also, I wish we had a better treatment that wasn't so toxic.
You compare the day shift and the night shift as a nurse. And you write that it can be quieter at night, and that could be very nice to, like, watch the patients sleep in their most peaceful moments. But it's also the time when a lot of patients plumb their deepest fears and talk about death. You say in the darkness, the possibility of dying becomes less scary for some. But I'd imagine it becomes more scary for a lot of people. A lot of people get more afraid of the things that haunt them at night. What do you do when that happens? Did you want to be the kind of nurse where people would feel comfortable talking with you about those fears? And if so, did you have the time to listen?
The nice thing about night shift is you will usually have the time to listen if those fears come up. And I definitely want to be the kind of nurse people can share those fears with. Night and waking up in the night can bring a clarity. And you're right, it can be a clarity of being able to face your fears. It can be a clarity of being overwhelmed by your fears. And I remember one night shift, a very long-term patient we all knew very well, who just slowly was really just not going well. And it was obvious things were not going to be okay. And he needed to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. And his wife was there. His wife was always there. His wife was incredibly dedicated. And she just didn't want to help me help him go to the bathroom, even though she did it all the time. And I realized this woman is exhausted and she just wants someone to come in one time and take care of her husband for her. And so I was glad that I could do that.
Did people often say to you, I don't want to tell this to my family, but I'm really afraid of dying? I don't want to scare them, so I don't want to talk about it with them, but I need to talk to someone.
Actually, I see more people who know they're going to die and their family doesn't want to hear that. And I suppose it might be, maybe that's the sort of story I elicit from people, but they usually have a sense that the end is coming and it's really going to hurt the people who love them. And so that's a real impasse. And there can be a lot of secrets kept and silences. And that's one thing that palliative care can be really good at, is trying to sit with families and have those conversations. Because it often goes that the patient knows it's not going to be all right, and the family is just not on that page yet.
You tell a story, and I think a lot of people have witnessed this, of a woman whose husband was dying, and she couldn't really accept that he was dying, and he had been refusing food and water, as many people who are dying do. And she was a good cook and felt like that's what you do for family. You give them food, and it it awakens them and nourishes them. And she tried to feed him, and you had to intervene and explain why that was such a bad idea. What did you tell her? What do you tell family members when they try to feed someone who's dying and can't really eat anymore?
That is such a great question, because it really plagues people. Food is so fundamental. And their feeling is, I'm letting my husband starve to death, and that's wrong. So I have to talk them through the process of the body slowly going in reverse. All the processes we think of as normal and that are integral to life, they're all slowing down. And so the body just doesn't need food when someone gets very close to the end of their life. And in fact, they found that forcing someone to eat can mean they just have this food sitting in their stomach, they're unable to digest it, can actually make them more uncomfortable. So I talked to her about that, but tried to do it as gently as possible while also acknowledging the incredible love that was motivating her and trying to honor that, but make it clear that she needed to show her love by being close with her husband, by holding his hand, by talking to him, but not by feeding him.
When you were working in palliative care, was it a separate palliative care unit, or was it like a hospital room that could accommodate regular care or palliative care?
We would integrate it with oncology. It's very appropriate to do with oncology. So a lot of symptom management, vomiting, pain, but then also having these bigger, harder conversations about what do you want. And they've actually found through research that if patients get palliative care along with curative care, they actually do better. Their quality of life is better. They live longer. So it's really, really important to be integrating that. And the problem is sometimes oncologists can be just go, 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 and they're not thinking about what the patient is going through physically and emotionally, and now we're learning we need to address that so that people can do as well as possible.
I don't know if this is still the case, but I know, and you can tell me if it is, but I know for a long time to accept hospice care and that kind of palliative care, you had to sign off medical interventions other than palliative ones. And that's a scary thing to do. It means like you are definitely going to say, I'm dying and I don't want any kind of health care except palliative. And a lot of people, I think, were afraid or unwilling to sign away other options. You're talking about integrating medical care and palliative care, so you don't have to make that choice. For hospice, do you still need to make that choice?
You do still have to make that choice. And in fact, they're making the restrictions even tougher. So I've had patients who most likely will die in 6 months because they have a number of severe chronic conditions, but they don't technically meet the criteria for hospice. So not only now do you have to give up any kind of curative treatment, you also have to meet a very narrow definition of imminent mortality. So I'm not quite sure why we're headed this way bureaucratically as a country in terms of how we enforce what gets paid for and what doesn't in healthcare. It definitely feels like the wrong direction to go in. And yes, people feel like choosing hospice is choosing death. And especially when we put it in these terms of you can have curative treatment or you can have hospice, there's a big, big reluctance to even think about, well, could I be doing other things that can make me feel better while I'm suffering with this disease?
Is this like a cost-saving measure?
I guess it's a cost-saving measure. I think it's more the result of people not understanding that we need to have more of a sense of a continuum. And so we get this idea that we're going to do chemo and we're going to do chemo. And if the chemo gets you 2 more weeks, even if you spend it in the hospital feeling like you want to die, then that 2 weeks was worth it. We need to have a mind shift that says, you're going to have 2 weeks left. How do you want to spend them? Very different question.
Have you tried to give honest advice to patients, even when the advice is, like you were just saying, you probably only got 2 weeks left, you want this chemo, which is just going to make you feel worse? I mean, how blunt are you with patients when you feel like you can see the end, but you, on the other hand, you don't want to tell them what to do?
Right. I usually ask them what they're thinking about, and people will get there, most people. And interestingly enough, I've even had patients who I was signing up for hospice. This was after I started home care and was doing home hospice, who said, okay, I want to be dead in 5 days. This one guy said to me, Teresa, can you do that for me? I'm counting on you.
Was he kidding or serious?
I think he was serious.
What'd you say?
I said, well, we'll see what happens. he had a lot of pain and he was really tired of being sick. The other thing is, once he was on hospice, most likely we could have really treated his pain and then he might have changed his mind. So that's important. No one should be wanting to die because of pain if we still have options for treating their pain. Sometimes, though, we treat and treat and treat people's pain, and to make their pain go away, it's at a level where they're really just not conscious anymore. And that's hard for families.
My guest is Teresa Brown, who's just written a memoir about her experiences as a hospital nurse caring for cancer patients. It's called The Shift. After a break, we'll talk more about taking care of patients who are dying. And we'll hear from French actress Juliette Binoche. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Teresa Brown, who became a nurse in her 30s after teaching English at Tufts University. She's written her second memoir about life as a nurse called The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. She spent years as a hospital nurse taking care of cancer patients. She now does home palliative care. Do patients often ask you if they're dying?
No, they don't.
Why do you think they don't? Do you think it's because they know if they are?
I think it's because they're afraid and they want to just take things day by day. I did have a wife once asked me, she said, you know, I'm not new to this and I want you to just tell me, is he dying? And at that point, I was a pretty new nurse and I didn't have the experience to know to say yes. Now I would know to say that.
Why would yes be the right answer?
Because I got a sense that she really wanted to know, and no one else was telling her. Physicians can have a mindset of, we're, quote, thinking positively, we're focusing on the good that can come, and we're not going to talk about what if it doesn't work out. And they will sometimes pull the nurse aside and say, what's going on? The saddest instance I had of this was a patient who was doing very badly, who had a stem cell transplant, and it just was not going well afterwards, which happens. This woman was so incredibly sweet, and I wasn't even her husband's nurse that day, but she came up to me and she said, Teresa, I feel like everyone knows something that they're not telling me. And I thought, no one who loves their husband as much as she obviously loved her husband should feel like that.
So you told her?
I hedged because I wasn't her nurse, but I said things are not looking good and encouraged her to approach the nurse and the physician with specific questions. It's tricky because nurses can get in trouble if MDs see that we're introducing the topic of death and dying, and they feel like it's not appropriate.
How many patients would you have on your typical shift?
Usually four. if we were very lucky, three. I chose to start the book with just having three patients to be able to talk about what a luxury that felt like. Four is standard, but we could go up to five.
Is there a tipping point for you where you feel like it's more than you can handle while still doing right by each of your patients?
I can't imagine having six. Having five is very, very hard. And in fact, one day we had a nurse who wasn't able to come in at the last minute, and we were sort of divvying up the patients. And I said, well, I'll take one, because it didn't look like the four I had were going to have that much going on. And then the one I took was actively dying and died much sooner than we thought. And another one was actually really sick and needed a lot. And unfortunately, I ended up almost completely ignoring this poor family who had had the family member die. And they were so incredibly generous to me about it. I'm not sure I deserved it, but I appreciated it. So, yeah, you can get in way over your head and you don't realize it.
I've been in situations where someone I love is in the hospital and something should be done that's not being done. And I chase after the nurse and say, explain what the problem is and ask her or him to please take care of it as soon as possible. And I feel like on the one hand, I'm being a pest. And on the other hand, unless I take some action, it's not going to get taken care of. And my priority at that point is making sure the person I love is getting care. How do you feel when I come chasing after you in the hospital?
Yeah, and I would say in an ideal world, of course, you are doing absolutely the right thing. I 100% approve. I think if you feel that's what's needed, go for it. And on my best days, I would be there for you and I would be empathic. If I'm already running around because someone needs blood transfusion because somehow we didn't realize that they were really low and someone else has been screaming in pain and we just can't get the dose right and someone else is dramatically vomiting, I hope I would listen well, but I might be slow getting to what you want to do, unfortunately. We're all just a little busier than we should be.
I've had experiences with good nurses and bad nurses when I've had loved ones in the hospital. And when a nurse is really good, you so much want to express your appreciation. And so my loved one who was in the hospital wanted to tip the nurse. And I said, I think that's a bad idea. It's like they're not like your server at a restaurant. What's the protocol? Should you ever like tip a nurse? Are there gifts that are acceptable or unacceptable? What are some of the ways people have expressed their appreciation to you for better or worse?
Tipping, I'm pretty sure anyone would turn down. It would just seem unseemly. Mm-hmm. A very popular gift in my hospital was Starbucks cards. We would love it.
Oh, a gift card.
Yeah. Patients would leave gift cards, and there was some rule on the books, but no one ever took the trouble to find out what it was, and it wasn't enforced. So we love getting gift cards. And often people bring in cookies and chocolate, and that's wonderful. But I remember one nurse saying, you know, I wish someone would just bring in a lasagna. Because we never have time to eat. And then you go into the break room and you're hypoglycemic and you see all this chocolate. And so you eat all this chocolate, which doesn't really help you feel that much better in the long run. So to actually drop off a meal is wonderful. And we have had people order pizzas for us. We had a family where their daughter had died, a lovely young woman, and the mom sent in this catered lunch. And then she sent in a catered dinner for night shift. Because night shift often gets forgotten when we get presents. So food is nice.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Teresa Brown's new memoir about being a hospital nurse is called The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. After a short break, we'll hear from French actress Juliette Binoche. This is Fresh Air.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Hartford, reminding small business owners to look out for the warehouse of the unexpected, a faraway place that delivers meddling items meant to cause customer accidents and workplace injuries. But even when the unexpected does strike your business, The Hartford can help you prevail with property, liability, and workers' compensation insurance. Ask your agent for The Hartford by name.
This is Fresh Air. Our guest, the French actress Juliette Binoche, won an Oscar for her performance in the 1996 film The English Patient. She's also known in America for her roles in the films Chocolat, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, and Clouds of Sils Maria. She's now on stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in the title role of the Greek tragedy Antigone. This production of the Sophocles play, with a new translation, was first performed in Luxembourg, London, and Edinburgh earlier this year, and will tour in October with performances in Chapel Hill, Ann Arbor, and the Kennedy Center. We're going to hear the interview Binoche recorded for our show with Fresh Air contributor Anna Sale, who hosts the podcast Death, Sex, and Money. In Antigone, Binoche plays the daughter of Oedipus. Her brother fought and died in a civil war. He's considered a traitor by her uncle, King Creon, the ruler of Thebes. Creon has decreed that the brother should not be afforded the dignity of a burial. Antigone defies the order, buries her brother, and is sentenced to death. She says she's responding to a higher demand than the ruling of an authoritarian king. This clip is from a BBC film made of the production.
What they call law did not begin today or yesterday. When they say law, they do not mean a statute of today or yesterday. They mean the unwritten, unfaltering, unshakable ordinances of the gods that no human being can ever wrap round. These laws live forever. No one knows how they were born. You thought I would transgress them for fear of some mere mortal man's decree? No.
Juliette Binoche, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
What about this play in particular, this tragedy, were you drawn to?
Sophocles is still 2,500 years after. He's still bringing so much truth in our lives. I'm fascinated by it, and how can a play can survive that amount of time? Because it does bring the questions about the politics, the gods, the beliefs. It's a very powerful play.
One of the questions is, what is the appropriate treatment of terrorists, people who are deemed terrorists by the state? And just months before the play opened in London, there were, of course, the shootings in Paris, the Charlie Hebdo shootings. I wonder, how did that affect your interpretation of the play and how you saw your character?
It did bring some questions to me, because I was reading in the newspaper that the criminals who did that, nobody wanted to bury them. The region, you know, where they were born or were raised, didn't want to bury them. Everybody was trying to avoid it. And a Muslim community finally, in the middle of the night, buried them, hidden from the others. And it really brought the question to me, you know, because Antigone, my character in the play, is burying her brother, who's a criminal as well. And nobody wants to bury him, but Antigone, her sister, wants to bury him. And so I thought, okay, this is the case of the Gides, you know, who nobody wants to bury them, and yet they're being buried. I know me, Juliet, I would bury anybody. If you're a human being, no matter what you've done, you have to bury your people. That's the law that is beyond, for me, questions. It's part of what we do. We have to bury our people. It says in Oedipus and Colonus that if you don't bury somebody, the soul will wander around until the eternity, the end of the eternity, which is never. And so for me, probably because I'm a mother, and there's something about giving birth, you give a body the chance to live, you have to take care of it until the end. There's no question to me. The moral judgment, you know, the good and bad is somehow on another level.
One of your first starring roles in 1985's Rendezvous was co-written by Olivier Assayas. And nearly 30 years later, he wrote and directed you in the film The Clouds of Sils Maria, which came out last year. In the role he wrote for you, you play a lauded and prolific actor, much like yourself, who is returning to a play that made the character famous. The twist in the film is that when you were young, you played the young ingenue, a character named Sigrid. Now you're playing an older, somewhat bitter woman named Helena, who falls in love with Sigrid. Let's listen to a clip, and to set it up, you are giving notes to the young actress who's now playing opposite you. The actress is named Joanne, played by Chloe Grace Moretz, and you are asking her about a pivotal scene where you're playing the older character, Helena, and Joanne, the younger actress, is playing Sigrid, the role you played years before.
I wanted to ask you, you know the scene at the beginning of Act 3 when you tell me you want to leave and I get on my knees and I beg you to stay. You're on the phone ordering pepperoncini pizza for your co-workers in the county. Yeah. Well, you leave without looking at me, as if I didn't exist. If you could pause for a second. You know, Helena's distress would last longer when she's left alone in her office. Well, the way you're playing it, the audience follows you out but instantly forgets about her, so...
So what?
Well, when I played Sigrid, I held it longer. I thought it was more powerful, dramatically. I mean, it really played well.
Well, no one really gives a f*** about Helen at that point, do they? I'm sorry, but I mean, it's pretty clear to me this poor woman's all washed up. I mean, your character, right? Not you.
You first had your breakthrough roles as that young ingenue. And you're at a different point in your career now. Have you felt the need to reinvent yourself as your character in this film does?
You know, ingenue doesn't mean anything to me, you know, because this innocence that has the flavor of innocence in the ingenue word is for me, you can be ingenue at any age. Innocence has nothing to do with age. And I would even say that as you peeling off in your life, you become more and more yourself. You take away all the education, all the fears. For me, it's there are changes in life, you know, that you definitely, you cannot hold on to things when you're reaching at a certain age, because when you're holding on, it doesn't work. And this scene you just played, it's a pivotal scene for my character in the film, because it's the moment where she sees there's no going back. Mm-hmm. And when she accepts that, she cannot possess anyone, she cannot change anything, she cannot, she doesn't have the power as before. Somehow she gets onto another level of consciousness and onto a level of freedom, and you gain your freedom. To get to the core of yourself. That's really what I'm experiencing.
The character that you play in the film, named Marie Anders, has many similarities with you in your career. You both broke
out. Well, you think that. Well, and the director makes you think that. That's how good he is.
You can tell me the ways that you're quite different from Marie, but there are notable similarities. You both broke out as young actors on stage. You both
That's
performed.
What happens to actors mostly.
That's true. you both performed in The Seagull. Both you and the
yeah, that
the
I said to him, you're tricky, you know, because you take real information and put it into your film. And he laughed because he knows it's true.
You were just turning 20 years old when a photo of you caught the eye of Jean-Luc Godard. And he approached you about a meeting. And you starred in his 1985 film, Hail Mary. Do you know what he was responding to from that photograph of you? Do you have a sense?
Well, to tell you the truth, it was my first boyfriend. It was an Italian, wonderful person, actually, very nice and very generous. He really took care of me when I had no place to live, no money, no nothing. And I was, you know, being a cashier in a big department store and doing my theater classes in the evening because my parents couldn't help me financially. And I remember he was taking pictures at the time. He had a camera, and I asked him to take pictures of me. And I would develop the pictures myself in the bathroom, you know, developing my films and doing, because it was less expensive. So one day I asked him to do some pictures and he didn't want to do it. And I was very pissed with him because I needed those pictures. So finally he took those pictures, but my expression was like pissed off at him. And my eyes were really saying it. So I think that the intensity of my face in this picture, it was the picture that Godard liked, yeah.
What was it like to work with Godard at the very start of your career?
You know, when I think back, I understand him more than at the time when I worked with him. Because as a young actress, you know, I was coming out of the school and the teacher, my teacher at the time, was just so taking time, being generous, you know, and mothering me. So when I went to Jean-Luc Godard's film, I thought he's going to help me, of course. And it wasn't that at all. Mm. He only had five people shooting, you know, the sound engineer, the DP, the maybe a script. And I remember he was quite impatient. But when I look back, he always wanted, he always shot when he really felt like shooting. So there was some kind of sincere need that he was in touch with himself. And that I really appreciate now that I know it. At the time, I remember that I didn't know which way to go, because one day he was giving me a monologue and say, I'm going to put an earplug in your ear and give you the text, because it was one day after the other and I didn't have the memory to, you know, perform this monologue. And then I arrived on the set, you know, ready to go with this monologue, and they said, no, finally just say those two sentences, that's enough. You know, so I had to adapt with his emotions going up and down. So I was very insecure. I knew we couldn't bear any makeup. And because I was getting red like crazy at the time, you know, my emotions were really close to my skin. So I remember being very ashamed of all the reds coming on my cheeks, things like that, you know, simple things.
Both of your parents were performers. Your mother was an actress, your father an actor and director.
So my father actually was touring around the world in a theater, you know, group he had. He was not sending money, so it was very insecure somehow. And my mother, she was an actress. She was, you know, studying in all this. And that at 30 years old, she stopped everything and went into study literature, French literature. And she got her exams and she became a teacher. So that was very courageous of her. But then at 50 years old, she stopped everything and went back to acting and directing and writing as well. So I had parents that were very kind of available to whatever they were feeling they needed to do somehow. They didn't try to be too conventional. In that way, that was a wonderful, you know, model as you go with what's inside. It doesn't seem secure from outside, but inside, you have to start from inside. And that's really what happened. So whether I was an actor or a painter or a dancer, it didn't matter, or whatever I wanted to do, it didn't matter. It's just that you follow what's inside.
So you started studying theater and acting as a teenager.
Yeah.
And then you lived with your sister
after leaving school? 15 years old, I was still at school, and and the idea whether I was going to go to a boarding school, you know, an hour from where my mother was living, or go to Paris with my sister and live there with my grandmother, actually, was working. We were living in a Presbyterian because she was the cook of the priest. And we rented a little studio there where I lived with my sister.
You and your sister, how old were you?
I was 15.
And how old was she?
18.
How did your relationship with your sister change when you became famous?
She went to China for a year during that period of time when I became more well-known actress in France. So when she came back from China, she was very surprised. And she actually changed her name, because every time she had to sign a check, she had to say how we were related and all that. And it was really a pain in the ass for her. So, you know, I totally understand. Probably not easy for her to start with now. I mean, we talked a lot about it. We're very close.
I want to ask you about what happened in your life in 1996 when The English Patient came out and was this critical and commercial juggernaut, winning 9 Oscars, including yours for Best Supporting Actress. How did starring in that film change your life?
The shooting was, to start with, literally, my hands were trembling. I was so frightened. I don't know why. I think it's had to do with the challenge of it. There was something that I was playing this role scared me. I don't know exactly what it was, but there was an inside feeling that made me shake. Hmm. And then the second month of shooting, I was totally confident because I was in his arms somehow, in Anthony Minghella's arms, because Anthony Minghella was a force.
He
was, he has this ability to support in being present and intelligent and adapting himself. And he had a vision of his film quite clear and very supportive and loving. And so so after that, the whirlwind of the promotion and the amount of interviews we did for the film around the world, traveling around, it was like new to me. But, you know, to tell you the truth, just before the Oscar, 3 months before, I was fired from a film, Claude Berry's film. And it was the most horrible experience I had because I've never been fired by anyone because I give myself so much, 200%. I didn't expect it. And I was really at the bottom of the, how do you say, the well?
Yeah.
That, you know, 3 months before. And so when I got the Oscar, it was like a big joke to me. I just could laugh inside so much because life is never ends. You know, it's always surprising you.
Did it transform your life?
It transforms my interviews.
That's funny. Juliette Binoche, thank you so much for joining us on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Juliette Binoche spoke with Fresh Air contributor Anna Sale, who hosts the WNYC podcast Death, Sex, and Money. Binoche is starring in a production of Antigone at the Brooklyn Academy of Music with performances through October 4th. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, I'll talk with Dr. James O'Connell about his 20 years treating the homeless in Boston, on the streets and in shelters.
We see dramatic things that I never saw in medical school or often even in the textbooks.
Things like severe frostbite and end-stage untreated diseases. O'Connell has a new memoir. It's called Stories from the Shadows. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Charlie Kyer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.